The Midweek Drive Team, four words which signify quality and all that's best in audio entertainment.
Percent of workers have borrowed money from family or friends in the last year. A further 26% have worked more overtime, with 11% taking on an additional job. And indeed, only 9% of workers would actually seek help from their employer if they were struggling with debt. We are living in trying times and challenging times. And certainly, the whole issue relating to finances can be very, very nerve-wracking. So to actually hopefully begin to allay some of those fears and provide us with some possible routes, we're delighted to welcome again to the program leading financial well-being specialist, Jonathan Watts-Leigh, to the program. How are you, Jonathan?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you.
Excellent. Now, obviously, that particular interesting interaction, that sort of, how are you? Yes, I'm fine, etc. Many people would actually take that as a matter of course, etc. But if you then actually dug a little bit deeper in terms of, so how do you feel about your money? You may get another response at all, or you may get no response. I mean, this is one of those challenges that starting those communication conversations can be quite challenging, I would have thought.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there's something in the British psyche, I think, which says, you know, we don't really want to talk about money. So whilst people may generalize about cost of living and the price of things going up and you know, having to remortgage and interest rates going up and all the rest of it, whilst they generalize, often they won't personalize it. So people can often be struggling quite a lot, but actually they won't talk about it. Some will talk to friends and family. But actually, you'll find that actually more broader than that, they keep it to themselves. And of course, that can be a problem in itself, because it's fine if you're struggling a little bit, but you can find a way through it, and maybe friends and family can help you with that. But of course, it's often quite a thin line between just about managing and then getting into a spiral, a downward spiral, where debts start building up and things start getting out of control.
We're talking, obviously, as part of Debt Awareness Week. From the research that was carried out, that Wealth at Work actually explored, were there any aspects which particularly surprised you, or you found challenging, or was it better or worse than you expected?
Yeah, I think a bit of a mix, really. I mean, some of the data that came out, so roughly one in five people said that they were taking on more debt now than they had previously. So to a certain extent, you may say, well, is that surprising that people are taking on more debt? But actually, when you think, well, that's one in five, that feels like quite a big ratio. 20% of people are saying they're taking on more debt. I think also the other thing that really came through was how people related money worries to their mental health. So some of the figures that came out, 38% of people said that their stress levels had increased. 33% said that they felt as though they were suffering from mental exhaustion because of money worries. Another 26% said that they felt as though their motivation was going because they were so concerned about their financial situation. So I think maybe one of the more surprising things, and one of the things that doesn't get talked about so much, is that link, if you like, between financial worries and the impact that that can have on people's mental well-being overall.
You raised the issue, of course, about debt there. Is there a stigma that also ties in with mental challenges, mental health challenges, that somehow it's seen as almost a failure, an admission of a failure to actually say, yeah, you are basically up to your neck and possibly beyond in terms of debts that have accrued?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think people do worry about it. And I think the other thing is people don't know where to go. And I think this is one of the things that we want to talk a lot more about, because things like the employer is very important. The employer may be able to help. More and more employers now are putting in support mechanisms, not only to help people with their mental health, but actually to help people with their financial health as well. And as those the link between those two things become more obvious, then I think more and more employers will do that. But again, often employees don't actually know that. They don't understand that. I think also it's important that they understand that there is help out there. There are places that they can go. There's a whole range of organisations, everything from the Citizens Advice Bureau through to Step Change, which is a debt charity that will give free advice. And in fact, even if you go onto the government website, and you look up debt advice, in fact, there's a list of organizations that can potentially help. So I think one of the messages really is that if people are worried about this, particularly if people think, I'm now getting to a point where things are getting a little bit out of control, start talking to some of these organizations, including your employer, who may be able to help.
Does the size of the employer matter? I mean, would it be a case of, well, it's okay talking to a full corporation in the public sector about challenges, but if it's just a small, medium enterprise and there aren't that many employees working for us, etc., I'd feel quite concerned about having to ask for a raise or other aspects of wealth management.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's a very reasonable comment, and I think that's why individuals need to understand the range of organisations they can go to. So I think you're right. Generally, I mean, I'm speaking generally. It's not a hard and fast rule, but you are right. If you work for a larger company, then they're more likely to provide help. But then those that don't, there are still these other organisations. And again, looking at the debt advice page on the government website can be helpful, because it does list organisations, as I say, everything from Citizens Advice Bureau to Step Change to the National Debt Line, and actually quite a number of others as well. So I guess the real point is that there is support there, no matter kind of who you are and where you work.
And with those organisations that you've just mentioned, and obviously people can play back the programme again if they haven't quite got them down, would you also counsel that it's important that people who might be listening to this who are struggling financially and they happen to be a worker, etc., they don't struggle in isolation and feel they can fix it themselves, that they can actually initially talk to family and friends, and if they can't do that, then actually open up a conversation?
Yeah, I think that's really important, because it is The thing is that debt can actually spiral out of control very, very, very quickly, and sometimes it can be managed if people get support early enough. And some of that stuff sounds, can be actually quite simple stuff. I mean, some of the things that we do when we go into employers to help employees with this type of thing, some of it is just actually looking at your weekly or your monthly budget and go, okay, so let's have a look at where you're spending money. And there are certain things that would actually be quite easy for people to do, but actually they don't do them because they probably don't think about it. So just to give you a couple of examples, increasingly we're finding that people have direct debits for subscription services, so for movies and music and all that type of thing, publications, whatever it might be. And often they have multiple subscriptions, some which are almost duplicated, and others which they simply don't use, but they've just forgotten about them, and the money just goes out on direct debit every month. We also see a lot where, when you look at relatively big ticket items, but pretty much everybody has them. So when you think about broadband contracts, mobile contracts, insurances, so car insurance or house and contents insurance, people still do not shop around for those services, and yet they could potentially save hundreds and hundreds of pounds for, if you like, the same service or the same cover if they did shop around. So in the early days when people are struggling, there are actually some quite simple things that people could do which could potentially help them and ensure they don't get into that more serious situation.
Jonathan Watts-Lay, leading financial well-being specialist from Wealth and Work, Wealth at Work, I should say. Many thanks. If people want to find out more details about Wealth at Work, so they just type that into their search engine.
Wealthatwork.co.uk, and they will see the research and some other hints and tips that could help them.
Incentives. We all like incentives. Incentives can actually make the world go round, arguably. And certainly when it comes to electric vehicles, maybe we also need to think about an incentive for that, because recent findings suggests that the rollout of electric vehicles is being driven, no pun intended, by fleets and firms, with private buyers accounting for less than one in five electric vehicle purchases. So let's talk about this in a little bit more detail with a so who certainly understands the whole process of this, and that is Luke Broad from Dasha UK. How are you, Luke?
I'm very good. How are you?
Yes, okay. I haven't actually moved to electric as yet. Still hesitant to do so. How can you persuade me and many others to actually say, let's make that change? Or is it a case of we need more incentives from the government?
Well, actually, I'm an EV pragmatist, if I'm being totally transparent, and EV makes a lot of sense for a lot of people. However, for a lot of people, it's also not quite right yet. But in terms of incentives for the government, I mean, you touched on earlier about the fleet sales of electric cars, and as you mentioned, this is what is really, really driving the market at the moment. However, with this car that we're launching today, the Dacia Spring, it's priced from just £14,995, and not only are we targeting the growing fleet market, but we really see this car as a strong retail proposition for customers in making electric cars more accessible. And that is without government incentives for retail buyers as well. So we put our own incentive in place. Customers who pre-order the car, they'll be able to get £250 towards a wall box, accessories, or public charging mileage. And we'll see what will happen. But so far, we're really pleased to launch the car at this price point, and we hope it will make electric cars more accessible for more people.
I was intrigued to see that Dacia has actually been around since 1968. I mean, you haven't been brand director since then, Luke, but in terms of obviously the progress from that point of view, clearly it's a successful company. It sold more than 8 million vehicles since 2004. It's based in 44 countries. Do you feel that actually there is a general move to take up EV purchase, but it is a case of uncertainty about things, as you just mentioned, charging points and so on?
Yeah, I think so. And more and more people are considering electric vehicles. You touched on the registration growth on that powertrain earlier. So people are buying these cars, and it's the fastest growing fuel type that people are buying. Not so much in retail as we've touched on, which is a little bit more challenging. But again, the government has set the target. 80% of the market in 2030 needs to be 100% EV sales. So manufacturers will react accordingly, and the way that you do that is by making the purchase proposition as compelling as possible and making the switch as easy as possible for people who are doing that.
The Dacia Spring is or was the third most sold electric car to individuals in 2022 and 2023. Are you confident that it's going to be the most popular car in 2024 as well?
Well, I would say there is not another brand new car out there that you can get at the price point we have launched at and with the features and quality of the vehicle ingrained into the car. You know, you can have Apple CarPlay, Android Auto, the car has Lane Keep Assist, all of these things that you might not necessarily expect for a car at the price point, but lo and behold, we've launched the car with some great features and at a great price. So I would say we've got all of the ingredients to the cake correct. We just need to make the cake this year and we'll see.
We know that there are a variety of vehicles that are obviously on the roads already. I personally have always preferred the slightly smaller car, the kind of Kia Picanto, he says, giving a shameless plug from that point of view. I mean, also, I often see electric vehicles, and they do seem to be the equivalent of substantive, big, bulky vehicles, etc. Is the small car something which is also likely to be benefiting from the Dacia brand?
Yeah, I think so. So the Dacia Spring, as you touched on, it is a small car, and in the industry we classify it as an A-segment car, which is, you know, your Kia Picanto, Renault Twingo, or your Fiat 500. But the way that we've been able to launch the car at the price that we have is to really look at what are people in the main using their electric vehicles for. And what we can see is they're travelling only 23 miles per day. And because of that, we've said, well, we don't need to put a huge battery in our car, because you put a huge battery in, you add cost for us as a manufacturer, cost for the customer who has to pay for the thing. And not only that, you're carrying this huge weight in the car, which is reducing the efficiency. So what we've said is, right, customers travel 23 miles per day. Let's put a reasonable size battery in there. You know, the car will do 186 miles in urban usage or 137 miles in mixed usage. And we'll price point it at something that is accessible for the majority of people. So as I mentioned earlier, I think we've got all the right recipe for success. We've focused heavily on efficiency of the car. And proof will be in the pudding as we see the deliveries commence towards the end of this year.
We've discussed the affordability of the car, clearly. What about sustainability? Is this a car which effectively our eco friends will be quite happy that it's good for the planet as well?
Yeah, so not only is the car green because it's an electric vehicle, but the car was also recently awarded, middle of last year, Euro Green NCAP 5-star. So this is an organisation that looks at how the car is produced, how recyclable is the car, and it's been awarded the highest rating. So, you know, the car is green, the car is sustainable, and it will help people transition across to electric cars in an affordable way.
And finally, Luke, where can people actually find out more details about the Dacia Spring?
We have put everything people need to know on dacia.co.uk, including the really exclusive pre-order offer where people can leave a £99 deposit, secure their place in the queue, and also get £250 back in value. So dacia.co.uk.
Luke Broad, Managing Director of Dacia UK, huge thanks. And may you have a good spring in your step for the rest of the year, Luke.
Thank you very much, Alex. Sun is shining, the weather is sweet, yeah. Make you wanna move your dancing feet now. Gather the rainbow, yeah, yeah. Want you to know I'm a rainbow too now. To the rescue, here I am. Want you to know can you thank you.
is sweet now. Make you wanna move your dancing feet, yeah. But to the rescue, here I am. Want you to know just if you can, here I stand. No, 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 no. Can you understand me now, baby? Do you believe me?
Siren radio, sound up everyone, save a siren sound.
Siren radio.
Come link into Miami, Paris to LA. Our global community wants to hear it play. Students participate, keep on keeping up, keep on keeping up.
Siren Radio,
keep on keeping up.
Siren Radio,
keep on keeping up.
Siren Radio,
keep on keeping up. Save Siren Radio.
Time for more movie thoughts, reviews, and royal commentary from Richard Fitzwilliams and Natasha Wanton on the Midweek Drive.
Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs.
When you write that?
All my life.
Hit.
Reggae is the people music.
You know you're a superstar.
I am a superstar. You can't separate the music and the message. You see, reggae music come to unify the people.
Not everyone likes what you're saying. For your own safety, you need to stop.
Assassins invaded Bob Marley's home and attempted to take the life of the singer, his wife, and...
Don't worry about that. Don't worry about a thing. That every little thing gonna be alright.
You like that one?
Yeah.
There's a war going on. Oh, I can't bring peace. I can't even get peace for myself.
Rise up this morning. Smile with the rising sun. Three little birds. It's by my doorstep.
Sometimes the messenger has to become the message.
Bob, I know it's dangerous. But you're the only one who can unite the people.
You ready, Bob?
No guns can stop this message. I want the world to change. And that time is now.
I think we may be joined by Natasha Wanton and possibly Sarah Huntley. We don't know. Certainly Anna Koshkinel will be with us. But the most important person, obviously, as we know from these sort of things, is, of course, our ace royal correspondent and reviewer, who I believe Hasn't been involved with any kind of photoshopping at all, unless, of course, you've been keeping something quiet, Richard, in terms of, obviously, the latest royal furore that's all about how ill is Princess Catherine these days? Or is it just a case of let's just Photoshop the whole thing?
I can only say that it has been a bizarre week for the royal family, and it's still going on, you know. I was still interviewing about it and going into next week. And indeed, one of the problems of this, and it has been an extraordinary experience, is that it isn't going to go away any time soon. And the reason for that, of course, is that Catherine is not carrying out royal duties until, well, the earliest is after Easter now. After all, she looked pretty dynamic, I thought, in that photoshopped image, and it was an image of her that hadn't been touched up. Unless you are looking at the telltale rings.
It's the sleeves. It's the sleeves. And the propensity to actually have miniature Donald Trumps towards one side, honestly.
One of the difficulties of this is the fact that one of the most avoidable scandals, if you like, to dignify it with that word, that's hit the royal family. I mean, the background to it is simple. 2.5 months since Christmas, which was the last time we saw Catherine, and indeed we knew subsequently she'd gone into hospital nearly a fortnight for abdominal surgery, didn't want the details known, and subsequently has been recuperating. Now, the problem with all this is that during that entire period, we hadn't had a message officially. There have been odd comments from sources from her and about her, a photograph, and the entire thing would have died down. In fact, it would never have swirled to the extent that it did, because the problem, of course, not only being that King Charles is receiving treatment for cancer, but also 3 weeks ago or so, Prince William pulls out at the very last minute of the memorial service to his godfather, King Constantine of Greece, which is being held at St. George's Chapel, Windsor, which is next door to where he was based, his home. Now, this is for a personal matter. And then the speculation, which has already been growing online, I'm not suggesting for a scintilla of a second that anyone sane would start making policy.
She's been kidnapped by aliens, Richard. She's currently residing on Mars, and nobody wants to let us know because of the mass panic that would ensue.
Or
well,
maybe she's chasing those turkeys.
We're referring to Land of the Giants, actually, a classic television show which Anna has recently reviewed, in which a giant turkey was at the heart of the major plot line, in which case she might well also be dealing with giant turkeys as well.
I cannot prove that she isn't, Alex, but I can say, just if I may develop, that all of the speculation was expected to be quashed by the palace by the release of a photograph of Catherine with her three children, taken by William, destined for Mother's Day, and that's when it was released, and indeed seemed an absolutely charming image to me. I was rather thrilled she looked so well.
Fake, Richard. All fake.
Come midnight, I'm settling down to watch the Oscars peaceably, and of course...
You can't settle down to watch the Oscars when Jonathan Ross is presenting. That's just physically impossible.
No, well, I wasn't able to see very much of what he was saying, because those are the bits that were the commentators, and I was doing other work. Mm-hmm. However, there is no question whatsoever that when it was, well, the news agencies, the five top news agencies withdrew the photograph. They refused to...
They're not going to be manipulated by the royals in some sort of godforsaken former empire-running country.
Well, there you are, Alex. You see the issue of credibility, the issue of trust. the issue of AI and how it could be. I mean, this was absolutely tailor-made for our age because you had Sky and the BBC, for example, devoting almost 10 minutes of the top of the newscast to an AI expert photographer talking about how it was possible to doctor images, because of course all of this was followed by an apology from Catherine, who said that she did occasionally alter images as a keen amateur photographer. Edit was the phrase she used. And subsequent to that, of course, unprecedented, furore went worldwide. It already had. And indeed, she was then briefly cited in a very curious development in Datchet near Windsor. And Prince William went to the Commonwealth Day service, where he was seen with the members of the royal family, including Queen Camilla. And subsequently, it swirled around with all the questions it supposedly raises. There's little doubt this was a form of hysteria. The problem is that it was a gift to conspiracy theorists. It was a gift to Republicans. Basically, it was an own goal of spectacular proportions.
Richard, thankfully, we can actually say if the concepts of our videos are ever released from our particular perspectives and the way we put together that everything that actually is here is completely real, and there's no such thing as any kind of doctoring that occurs whatsoever in any image. That's because we have one love, in every sense of the word, as Bob Marley would actually say when he's not jamming and looking for those three little birds that may or may not have actually had their images doctored as well.
Well, Alex, there you have it. Bob Marley, One Love. And indeed, I would just mention that the premiere of this was held in, obviously, Kingston, Jamaica. Bob Marley, a Jamaican legend, and the film was attended by Harry and Meghan. Now, Jamaica is still one of the King's realms, but it may well, and indeed is, supposedly moving towards a republic. It will need a referendum before that's finalised. But Harry and Meghan there seemed somewhat provocative to commentators here. But to switch to the film, this is directed by Reynaldo Marcus Green. Now, what he scored, and I thought scored so well in, was King Richard about the Williams sisters, and indeed very successful. Good performances, very well done. He's also the co-writer. We deal with half a dozen years in Bob Marley's tragically short life. He died of skin cancer at the age of 36. We begin in 1976. There's armed conflict between political parties. Marley announces he's going to perform at a peace conference, but he and his wife Rita are shot as a gang attacks them, forcing her and the children to go to the America, and he and the band go to London. Now, here he seeks inspiration, and this is, there's quite a lot about the creation of the Exodus album, inspired, actually, the title by the film of that name. And this hit popularizes reggae. And, of course, there's the Rastafari movement, which benefits. And we never learn much, by the way, about this and about his faith, something the film could have gone into. He's stages the One Love Peace Concert in Jamaica, and at this, the heads of both political parties, Edward Seaga and Michael Manley, are joined together. So Marley is seen, and this is the way the film obviously shows him, as something of a saint, and there's no doubt that he was remarkable. Indeed, this was an achievement that was, well, it showed the power of music. Here we also climactically see his performance at the Zimbabwe Independence celebrations. Then there's quite a segment of his relations with his wife, Rita, played by Lashana Lynch. I have to say that, again, there's hints of his affairs and so forth, also hers. There's one strong argument between them, and her part isn't really fleshed out. And the same goes for James Norton as the Jamaican-British record producer Chris Blackwell. He's known for popularising reggae in the world. Kingsley Benadier, extremely good as Bob Marley, said he looked the part. He appears to have perfected the Jamaican patois. But as a film, this is not done well. The script, the editing, it isn't, apart from the beginning where we have the shootings, it isn't particularly dramatic.
Is it not as good as Bohemian Rhapsody, Richard?
No, it's not as good as Bohemian Rhapsody, Alex. Bohemian Rhapsody was excellent. And indeed, we've had there are a pretty large number, and we've still got more to come. I think there's one of Amy Winehouse coming. Biopics.
What about Rocket Man with Elton John? Is it as good as that?
I'm afraid it isn't as good as that. Indeed, it's only got 43%. I had a look on Rotten Tomatoes. One of the problems is, despite a good central performance, and indeed, see constant flashbacks. Molly's father was something of a mystery to him, and that is clear, is seen as such in the film. It isn't a particularly successful film, either as a sort of docudrama or as a biopic, which doesn't really go into any detail, anything that isn't, superficial. Obviously, it is a favourable portrayal, but it could have done with some of the power of King Richard, in the sense that those tennis court scenes, when you think of that movie, you can see the balls being hit across that court by the sisters. And there were really fine performances. I do have to admit that the patois, if you are not familiar with it, is tricky to understand at times.
But it's got dreadlocks in, Richard. Dreadlocks and Bob Marley music.
It's got that, and I think his fans will enjoy it enormously. I'm sure they will, but Kingsley Benadire, very good indeed. He brings across some of the charisma, but what you didn't have was other parts fleshed out, which would have given us a better understanding, I think, of him.
I'm sensing a kind of 6 out of 10 for Bob Marley's wonderful One Love. Which is most peculiar. Natasha Wanton, as one of the only people on this particular programme that has not actually met Richard Fitzwilliams in the flesh, which even Anna Koshkinel can actually say she has met Richard Fitzwilliams in the flesh, as indeed Sarah Huntley has also met him in the flesh, as indeed have I, or in the fox, shall we say. Any thoughts on Bob Marley and One Love? Would you say actually Richard's being too harsh on this, and just because he had issues with his wife and his family doesn't necessarily mean that he should be cancelled outright?
I've got nothing against Bob Marley. I honestly don't know much about him, so I wouldn't be able to offer an educated opinion about the man. Not massively into his music, but it's not anything that's particularly I find offensive or anything like that. I think the music's fine, just not the genre that I'm into. It's not really a film I think I'm going to watch. I would very much like to pick Richard's brain about the Oscars, though. I have lots of questions about that, but I'll let you ask everybody else.
That's a long way away. And besides, the bottom line is, with respect to that, we have to actually sort of eliminate it, because the wrong person was given Best Actress. It clearly should have actually been Lily Gladstone.
That is an absolutely scandalous thing to tempt me with. And you are tantalising.
Anna Koshkinel, who has recently met Richard Fitzwilliams in the flesh, have you got any comments on One Love?
Well, it does seem like an interesting movie. I can't say it's my type of music, but my parents, my mom in particular, and my grandparents used to listen to that. So I can't say I grew up listening to him, but I do know quite a few of his songs. And I think my mom would be more eager to watch it rather than me. But what I have read about it, people are quite excited about it. And they say that despite the critics and other people, it was quite a good representation of
indeed
the story.
Sarah Huntley, never knownly photoshopping in any way, shape or form from that point of view. As I say, I like to maintain that we don't do that. What about your love for Bob Marley? Because I'm sure that at the Actors Centre, a little bit of reggae, little Johnny Reggae is an essential part of any actor's training.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I love the music. And for me, I remember when I was in the Caribbean on a catamaran and they were playing Three Little Birds. I know it's not probably typically me, but I do like Bob Marley's music very much. Mm. And my daughter was a bit obsessed by him, so I know quite a lot about his life. And how unconventional it was in one way, but I think I'd go just for the music, actually. I haven't seen it, but I wouldn't say no.
You see, if all else fails, go for the music and you will not be disappointed, especially as actually we don't actually have any particular sort of challenges with respect to that. Maybe we should actually go to L'Île Rouge, the Red Island, for another little adventure of family-based material, Richard. What say you, L'Île Rouge?
Absolutely, and I hope you'll give Natasha and I a chance at the Oscars afterwards, Alex. Yes. This is actually...
No, they didn't give Lily Gladstone a chance, so I think actually, you know, on that basis, we're completely blacklisting the whole thing.
You're delighting in being deliberately obstreperous and difficult on this.
Richard, I'm not wearing jeans. I would be allowed into any of your in-and-out clubs quite happily, you know?
A valuable moment we could be spending on the Oscars. Red Island is directed by Robin Campillo, and it's also co-written. And it's set in the 1970s in Madagascar. Now, Madagascar, by then, had its independence from France. And that is when Campillo spent his childhood there. So this is a charmingly autobiographical movie. But it's also... fascinatingly cinematic. The story of a 10-year-old boy and his family stationed in this French military base, which in fact the French are doing, is they're propping up the regime in Madagascar, which is not particularly, it certainly isn't particularly democratic. The reason for the title, incidentally, is the reddish colour of the soil of the island. And we meet young Thomas, played by Charlie Moselle, and he lives with his parents and, well, he's very much in clover. He can spend a lot of time, and we see some animated parts of this film, whilst pretending to be crime buster Fantonette, who was sort of all the rage at that time. I was going back 50 years, of course, in his imagination. Fantonette was a fighter against crime, and there are quite a few rather imaginative sequences linked to that. And again, the clever way this film gives an indication of what the French are up to whilst with their military there. Also about his family life and how the parents get on and the sexism of the period, the racism of the period and so forth. It's very interesting, but what you don't, this is where the film scores. You hear snatched conversations. You see a couple kissing, and you see what happens when someone deserts their French girlfriend and takes up with a Malagasy woman, and so forth. But you see it from various angles, snatched conversations, what the child hears, how his eyes are suddenly being opened to what's really going on. And that is a subtle and very, very intelligent way of... telling the story. The parents have ups and downs in their relationship, but essentially the child is absolutely in clover because, of course, the climate is glorious. Of course, they have films by the beach. They get unorthodox presents and so on. It does paint an idyllic portrait. And you get cuts to the French dropping the Malagasy parachutists to put down a farmers' revolt and so on. What it's ending up at, and I have to say that this is perhaps the only weakness of the film, I think, it does feel that it's got to become something of a political polemic climactically. And I'm not sure that it needed to do quite that in quite so obvious a way. But having said that, I was absolutely enchanted by it because visually it's so idyllic. And Thomas's mother, Colette, played by Nadia Tereskovich, and father, Robert, played by Queen Guterres, both excellent. You get an insight into a life that was, it was obviously propped up by a myth of racial superiority and also the military links can prop up a regime that's become repressive. And subsequently, it, as I say, becomes very political. But it's an enchanting view of a childhood that I think a large number of expatriates could probably relate to, and certainly visually very impressive and extraordinarily well acted. So I thought it was excellent.
Anna Koshkinel, is this a movie for yourself, or is it a case of, frankly, as I had to encounter Richard Fitzwilliams without a chaperone, I'm still in a state of shock?
Well, It was a pleasure to meet him. I'm not in shock anymore.
Yeah, it's taken two days there, Richard. You know, calm down.
Exactly, 2 whole days, but I'm good. And I don't think this is quite the movie for me or necessarily my genre, but I can appreciate the actors and their acting if necessarily.
Sarah Huntley, who I believe also, I do recall I was your chaperone when you first met Richard Fitzwilliam. So actually you were safe on that point of view. I was very worried because obviously I'd realised Anna was bravely going down to London without any kind of escort whatsoever. And we know, as I said frequently, you know, who knows what could actually have happened. Anyway, is this a movie for yourself?
Well, I have to put you right there. I think I met Mr. Fitzwilliams on my own.
No, I think you're wrong, Sarah, because we actually did a piece at the gallery, the National Portrait Gallery, where I first introduced you to Richard Fitzwilliams. So I'm afraid that was long before, many years ago, a good few years ago, basically.
Oh, okay, I'm wrong then. Yes, I think this is one for me. And I'm very drawn to things. I'm probably a bit too nostalgic these days, which isn't a good thing sometimes. But yes, I've seen the trailer for this and I was quite captivated by it. And it's a bit of the world that I don't really know anything about. So I would be fascinated to watch it. And the acting looked brilliant. And I think it's always interesting to look at through a child's eyes, what they remember of their childhood. So yes, I definitely think I'll go and see this. I think it looks rather good.
But we're all children really, Sarah, even Sarah Bullimore and Natasha and Natalie Smith, actually also children when they were doing a shoot for me back in the day, back in the early 2010s, which I popped up behind me. Anyway, over to yourself.
Well, I just comment on this. It looks like the new Avengers to me.
There's certain elements of that, I felt. So Sarah Bullimore in a red dress.
I'm going to come up with a title for what this film is called. If the listeners could see, there's Alex looking rather jaunty in a very smart black suit with the girls on either side.
I still
side.
Might not have been let in the in and out club even with wearing that suit, Richard. So, you know, it might well have been past the dress code.
And Alex, you certainly won't be if you don't let us talk about the Oscars. It's a Democratic majority.
Unlike the Oscars. Natasha, from your own point of view, L'Île Rouge, is this one for you?
I think this is certainly more up my street than the last movie that we were discussing. Look, I think it's going to be one of those ones that I'm going to have to watch to see whether or not I'll enjoy it. I like the concept that you're sort of given just little snippets and little teaspoons of information. I don't know whether or not that will continue to hook me or whether or not that will irritate me. So I'll need to watch it to see it. But by the sounds of it, it's a very beautifully shot movie. So I am sure I could appreciate lots within the movie, even if the story annoyed me a little bit.
Probably going to go for an 8 out of 10, I would have thought, in the Richard Fitzwilliam scenario.
Quite right, Alex. I mean, I'm not sure why I even bother to
we work our way through this. Well, sadly, well, from the point of view of obviously Christopher Nolan, he did actually wipe the floor with respect to the Oscars and the Academy Awards. I mean, heaven only knows. I mean, did you watch it, Sarah? Did you watch the ITV version of the whole thing? Or did you think, no, it's got Jonathan Wass on, so therefore I can't possibly cope with Jonathan Wass doing the Oscars?
In the Oscars. I did listen on the radio a little bit about it, but no, I didn't watch it. I've been rather busy myself, actually, not
exactly.
Oscar.
Getting on with the real world, effectively.
I,
Anna,
I would point that.
Were you an Oscar person, or was it a case of, no, frankly, I was psyching myself up then just to actually meet Richard for the first time?
I actually didn't watch it then, but I watched later on recordings. Mm. So
And Natasha? Clearly, what's the point? It's Australia, so why would you bother with this American gathering of whatever?
My favorite part of the whole thing was 100% Ryan Gosling's energy that he channeled throughout I'm Just Ken. That was the best thing I've seen in a while in an award show. It was absolutely fabulous. The joy you could tell that he was spreading to everybody's faces throughout was just excellent. Oh, so many different things I could talk about with this one. I didn't particularly like how there were certain reactions on social media to the animated Oscar win. I think that, you know, if you miss out on the award, you shouldn't really be sort of talking down about the other film on social media. I don't think that was okay. I particularly did not like how Robert Downey Jr. was spoken about by the presenter, by Jimmy Kimmel. I thought that his remarks about his past was abysmal. The man has been clean for 20 years. You let his past lie. You do not bring that kind of stuff up. You could tell he was really uncomfortable by it, and the fact that he just kept going at him was, I don't think that that was acceptable. The awards pretty much, I think, went how I expected them to. I mean, it's what it's been doing the whole award season, right? It wasn't, I don't think there was many surprises in terms of that. What I was surprised about was the reaction to the Emma Stone win compared to Lily Gladstone. It seems like Emma Stone's been getting quite a lot of hate online for it. And I was just interested to know sort of Richard's take on that and sort of where.
Oh, Richard's a big Emma Stone fan.
I know. It's just interesting that up until this point, there hasn't seemed to be much about it. And then the Oscars happen and suddenly there's all this hate for Emma Stone, which was interesting to me to see unfold.
Well, actually, you know, on the specific point, it became clear as the Oscars were nearing that we knew the winners in every category, insofar as you possibly can. I mean, the people were quoting back at the amazing win of Olivia Colman for playing Queen Anne in The Favourite, beating the wife as she should have been played by Glenn Close, The other one that was quoted was Anthony Hopkins, the father, beating Chadwick Boseman, and that hadn't been expected. But everything had been predicted, bar two. Now, it was abundantly clear as we were approaching Oscar Day, and especially with the scandal that they'd voted by then, affecting the holdovers, starring Paul Giamatti. The facts were Giamatti's, though superb. Clearly, when the SAGs went for Cillian Murphy and the actors are the largest of the groups for vote, it was obvious that Murphy was going to win. But when it came to Best Actress, it was not obvious, and the speculation about this and Emma Stone versus Lily Gladstone had been going on for weeks, and Gladstone appeared at one stage, appeared to have the edge, actually, but nonetheless, it was a question as to whether a performance that really was electrifying would beat one that was extremely sensitive, beautifully handled, I thought, in Killers of the Flower Moon, but wasn't, other than the fact she was a Native American. This was the reason, I mean, they allow some 11,000 voters for the Oscars. And would this, which is germane to the problem, to the policy of inclusivity, but if you actually took the performances and compared them, in my opinion, Emma Stone was it was just extraordinary as her journey with the brain of a child as it metamorphosed in this bizarre film.
But the good news, Richard, is I know Sarah Huntley is already working on a production scheme which is going to have Lily Gladstone portray the Princess of Wales in a photoshopping scandal in the near future.
Alex, if I may just finish on this, that there was one other particularly interesting aspect to the Oscars, which I've just discovered, and that is that 1.1 million saw part of it anyway on ITV. It had been moved forward an hour. Now, in America, it's still struggling. It's got 19 million. Now, that's up from 18 last time, roughly, but it is.
Curiosity, Richard, to see if Sky had actually made a big loss in refusing not running it. And if Rupert Murdoch's Sky Corporation doesn't want it, why would ITV want to pick it up, really?
When it came to Sky, only a few watched it because of the hours of the morning, because I say it has changed. But I thought that the whole, I mean, whether the In Memoriam service or the Billie Eilish song, or whether you have Ryan Gosling as a delightful Ken with 65 other Kens leaping around and electrifying, I agree totally with Natasha about that, and also about it was the one of the few false notes of the evening. Jimmy Kimmel seemed pretty assured. He's got the sort of presence to carry the Oscars perfectly well. It was totally unnecessary for the sort of cruel Ricky Gervais-like jibes at Robert Downey Jr.
Wouldn't have happened with David Tennant in charge.
Well, Ricky Gervais. I would go for Kimmel, and I think he did a very passable job because some of those jokes were very funny. And, you know, I enjoyed it insofar as, incidentally, I was able to enjoy it with the photo scandal just having broken.
Well, there we are. We've come full circle. Sarah, anything you'd like to add as a summation plot to the piece today?
No, sorry I haven't been around. It's been a rather busy time.
Rehearsals. Funerals.
Funerals, memorial services,
exactly. A lot.
I went to see Uncle Vanya last night at the Orange Tree Theatre, which was absolutely fantastic, and was rather moved at the end because Trevor Nunn has directed it. And when he was saying he'd always wanted to direct the Cherry Orchard, Uncle Vanya, which he hadn't, was the one he hadn't ever done. Brilliant cast. A friend of mine, Susan Tracy, was in it. And right at the end, he was talking. I hadn't realised what a short life Chekhov had, actually. He died by the time he was about 43, which even for those times was...
Much like Anthony Yelchin, the character who played Chekhov in Star Trek, also died at a similar age. Spooky, really.
Yeah. But he gave the whole production in memory. And I'm not going to say his name right. Can you say it for me, Alex? The guy who stood against Putin, who died last month. How do you say his name properly?
Alexei Navalny.
Yeah. And there was that mention at the end. And I thought, brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. So, yeah, that was a good one. And another one, if you're feeling stressed and really tense and you're getting up in the middle of the night and can't sleep, I watched a really naff thing, but I got hooked. I don't know if anybody else has watched it. It was fun. Bad Sisters. I really enjoyed Bad Sisters. Natasha, I think that's one for you. It's really good. It's about a murder, and you don't know who's done it right until the end. But it's funny and good all at the same time.
And I know Richard would also wish me to add congratulations, certainly, for a very hard-fought electoral campaign, but it looks likely. Obviously, we're still anticipating the results, just as we were with respect to the Academy Awards. It looks highly likely
that Vladimir Putin
will actually be elected as the leader of Russia.
There are three opposition candidates, apparently, and I must tell you what happened when there was an interview with the communist candidate, and he was asked. And there's a simple question. I support what Alex has said. I do think it's just likely that Vladimir Putin's going to hang in there.
There's a shock for the news.
He was asked, did he believe his policies, this is an opposition, supposedly opposition candidate, his policies were better than those of Vladimir Putin? He replied, it was not for him to say.
Keep watching the movies.